Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem with Unit 20, our final unit where we've been learning all the Mishnayot of Masechet Rosh Hashanah, and today, hopefully, we will finish it. Okay, let's jump right in. We're on Mishnah Tet. Last time we looked at Mishnah Chet, and we ended with the importance of the voice of the shofar, of the blower of the shofar, of the kol of the shofar that is the mitzvah. And now we're going to focus finally on what these blasts are. Mishnah Tet opens with the phrase Seder Tikiot, the order of the Tikiot, Shalosh Shel Shalosh Shalosh. And here you hear like a tongue twister, because even the shell, which like merges with the next shalosh, creates a feeling of shalosh. Three of three, three. And I will explain this to you in 1 second, what it means. But I just want to point out to you that although it seemed like all these mishnayot were somewhat disparate and didn't exactly link together, we do have another chiastic structure. If you remember, we had Seder Brachot, the order of the Brachot, which we learned in Mishnah Hey, were intrinsically linked to the Tikiot. Now we have Mishnah 9 has, that's the A at the beginning. Here's our A at the end. In Mishnah 9, we have Seder Tikiot, so we have Seder and Seder. We have the idea of the units of three that we're seeing, we're going to see here, and I'll explain to you in a moment about the blast. And we had the units of three with the verses, and it was also intrinsically linked to the units of three of the blessings, even though the word three wasn't used, but with the verses, the word three was used. And then we had in the middle the Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah and the Shofar Shel Rosh Hashanah. And so even though these Mishnayot seemed a little bit disparate, it's clear that the editor of the Mishnah wanted to put them and intentionally put them together in a unit. Okay. We also saw back in Mishnah 7, and I think I didn't fully explain it there, I forgot, that there was a link between the shofar and Hallel. And we saw that the prayer leader, who's going to appear again at the end of Mishnah 9, was the one who was makre, the verses of Hallel to the community. And how that worked is that to read them means to verbally read them out loud, and it was responsive. They would say hallelujah, they would respond hallelujah to the verses, and there would be like a sing-song. A first one says something, and then the community says something back, and this sort of ping-pong of a song, a responsive song that the hallel set them set a paradigm for. And then by comparing shofar, in which we had the sound of the brachot with the sound of the shofar having that ping-pong song together, we saw that there's definitely a musical aspect going on here. And that, I will say, was already hinted to us just as a theme in the chapter when we had the song of the Levi'im that was in the Mikdash. And we know the Levi'im used their voices to sing, and they also played the musical instruments like the Chatzer Tzra or the Shofar that we know that happened in the Mikdash. And so now we're going to focus somewhat on the musical aspect of the blast. And we're told that the Seder, the order of these blasts is the following. Shalosh, shel shalosh, shalosh. So it says three, where there's three of each. That seems how everyone understands that double shalosh, shalosh at the end is three of each. So what's the first three? The first three, and this brings us back to the brachot, the link to the blessings. The first three is that there's malchiot, that's one, zichronot, that's two, and shofarot, that's three. So for every one of these three, I have to have three in it. For each three, there is three of each. And the three of each, I don't fully know what it is. And the Mishnah, as I read through it, is going to explain to me what it is. It's going to be different types of blasts, different musical notes, different sounds that I can make with the shofar. And I would need to read to the end of the Mishnah, or to the middle of the Mishnah, which is the end about the Seder Tikiot, because at the end of this Mishnah, we're going to have something tacked on again that's a little out of place that we're going to have to analyze. But if you skip with your eye to the line where it says, Tokea umaria utokea shalosh pa'amim, that's right before the ending, sort of, I don't know what version you're looking at. It's a little before the ending. Or you'll take my word for it, that at the end of the Mishnah, you learn what is this three of three, that I have first a sound that's a tkia, then I have a sound that's a charua, and then I have a sound that's a tkia again, we're going to talk about what these are in one second. But so I have a unit of three blasts that that is in a certain structure. And I do these three blasts for each one of these three blessings, which should get me to a total of nine blasts that the Mishnah defines. I'm not talking about what is done today and how you get to 100 or 102 blasts. But if you look in your siddur, when you do sort of in the structure of the blasts that happen with the tefillot, you will see that they go in units of nine, even though we do more than that. And those units of nine actually are reflective of what was happening in the Mikdash each day. Those same sounds, tekiya, trua, tekiya, happen all the time in the Mikdash. They don't happen with a shofar. They happen with that chatzotra that we heard about in chapter three. We heard about it linked to the fast days. But it's actually sounds that are normally heard with the offering of the sacrifices, the daily sacrifices. And this is said at the end of Masechet Tamid. For the daily sacrifice in the morning of Shachar, they had these nine blasts, three times three. For the Tamid Shel Ben Arbayim, the evening constant sacrifice, they had three times three. And then it says even for Musaf, when there's an additional sacrifice, they had three times three. And so the concept of having the structure of three times three that we see here with the blasts and we saw it with the brachot is definitely makes us think about the temple, makes us think about the offerings to the divine, makes us think about ritual that happens in the temple. Okay, so on Rosh Hashanah, for each of these three blessings, I'm doing this three structure. And now the text tells me something about these blasts. It says, Shiur Tekiya Kishlosha Truot. The measurement of a tekiya, and in the manuscripts, instead of saying like three truot, it says kidei three truot, is for the length of time that it would take you. So it's not telling me what to hear, but it's telling me something about the length of the blast. So I have a longer blast and a shorter blast, and the relationship between them is a third. I can do three of the shorter blasts in the time that it will take me to do the one longer blast. And then if I want to know how long is the shorter blast, I have to know something else musical. Kashir trua kishalosh or kadesh shalosh yivavot. So the shorter blast, there's an even smaller blast that I don't normally blow that sound on Rosh Hashanah, but if I'm someone musical, I know this sound. It's a sound that is identified in the Babylonian Talmud as a sad crying sound. But I just want to tell you, nowhere in the sources from Israel is it actually identified as something negative. It's a raising of the voice. It's a short sort of raising of the voice, but it can either be happy or sad. And I just want to emphasize, I said this before, if you just purely look at the Mishnah, the sound of the shofar is not necessarily one of sadness or of yearning or of crying. All that comes from the Babylonian sources, and those may be very meaningful images for you of Rosh Hashanah, but it isn't the picture exactly that the Mishnah is painting. Here, we already talked about the link to the Yom Tov, to the Hallel, and I think there's going to be a link here to music. I think it's one of song. It's the sounds of notes of one of song that might be even more of praise, or we know we want a positive mentioning and awakening and reminding to the divine to go up through the shofar, and we want it to be positive so that the divine, this sounds kind of low crass and maybe not the best, but has like creates a warm, fuzzy feeling about us and remembers us for the positive. And so this is our voice in which we're speaking these reminders to the divine, and we want them to be pleasant sounding, I think. Similar to the sound of the Yovel, which is an exciting decree going out in the heralding noise. If anything, maybe it's heralding the king, like we herald this declaration of the Jubilee. in which all human beings are made equal, right? And the way we talked about this, the way human beings can be made equal is because there's one creator who created us and knows us, created us as one and knows our actions. So there isn't really, besides telling us something about the length and that these sounds sound different and they correspond to each other in some musical way, we don't exactly know what we're supposed to be thinking about. We know that the importance of the word zikaron we saw with the brachot, and that the brachot are so linked to the tikiot, to the blasts. So we have that information. And I spoke about the oval here, but the understanding of how we get to this original three that we need to have. And so if you see it's tikiya, trua, tikiya, right? And the understanding is that the one in the middle possibly is the most important, which is the trua. And you know that it, in the Torah, Rosh Hashanah is called Yom Trua or Zichron Trua. And so that seems to be the central one. And so how do they get to three? Because, right, I have a three truot, and then I put these tikiyot just like to be the before and after to this might sound kind of funny, but if I want to be sure I'm hearing a trua, I want to juxtapose it with a sound that isn't a trua so that I can hear the difference of the sound in some ways. That's my suggestion that I just made up right now as I was talking, but it seems interesting to me because all that they say is I learned the word trua twice from the two mentions of Rosh Hashanah, and I get a third mention of trua from the mention of Yovel that happens on Yom Kippur, which is in the seventh month, and I connect that to Rosh Hashanah. And so then I have these three truot, and then every truot always has a tikiya before and after. That's what they basically say. Like, that's how it's done. That's how it's musically done. So I don't know what to tell you. I can't explain it better than that. That's what I have in the sources. But I have this musical changing of notes of sounds so that I can hear the different sounds that the shofar makes. Then, and these sounds, I think, clearly are supposed to make us think of the yovel, of that jubilee and jubilation of equality and freedom for all human beings, which is, and a reverting back to original owner, which is linked to the divine being, the ultimate original owner of the world, right? The jubilee is seven cycles of the Shemitah, which we let the land lie fallow to acknowledge the divine as the original owner. And if you look in the verses about the jubilee, it expresses this idea. Then the Mishnah continues, and it says, Taka b'rishona u'mashach b'shnia k'shtayim ein b'yado ela achad. This line is hard to explain. I don't fully understand it. I can tell you it tells you that it says the following. If you blow in the first one, and most people maybe understand this is the first tekiya that's before the trua, and you continue into the second one as if the length of two blasts, you only can count it as one. So what I can learn from this is that human beings can use their mouths to change the length of the blast. And if you sort of slur the blasts together and don't have distinct sounds that are clear about their length, they can't count as individual blasts. And this sort of reinforces that the number is extremely important. This three is very, very important, maybe to make the link to the brachot, maybe to remind us of the two of Rosh Hashanah plus the Yovel, but the three is very important. And so if I blur them together and I don't have distinct sounds, it counts only as one. How exactly the person is blurring it together, some of the traditional commentaries make it seem like if I do the tekiya that comes at the end after the trua, and I try to lengthen it so much that it should count for the next tekiya, but that only is according to the practice that we have today, where we're doing three units for each one of the brachas, right? That we go tekiya, trua, tekiya, tekiya, trua, tekiya, tekiya, trua, tekiya, that set of nine for every single one. But according to the Mishnah, we're not behaving that way. So it's hard to understand it that way. So I'm going to leave that as I'm not sure what's going on here, but I'm going to take from it the information that I just gave you that re-emphasizes to me the importance of the distinct sounds and not blurring them together and the importance of the number. And then the Mishnah goes on to say, Mishe berech v'char kach nitmana lo shofar. And here's the line I already read to you. Tokea umaria utokea shalosh pa'amin. Someone who blessed, and now we're back to the fact that there's a link between the blessings, right? The whole time I've said there's been creating a link between the blessings and the shofar. Now something funny happens, and we are going to now disconnect it. Someone said the blessings already. They davened, apparently without a shofar, so they didn't have the shofar blast.
And only afterwards they were allotted one, or they happened upon one, or someone gave them a shofar. Now, the question is it, I the whole time I'm establishing that the blast and the blessings are so interlinked. Are they so interlinked that if I did one without the other, now I can't do the other? No, the Mishnah says no. If you did the blessings on its own and later on in Rosh Hashanah you got the shofar, do the blasts. And here it tells, here's where we know what the threes are, right? This is a different, it's a different reflection of shalosh, 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 right? I tell you what the shalosh is, trua, tokea, maria, tokea, and then I tell you three times. So that's the three of three, and I get that information. And so in some ways, the shofar and the blessings are intrinsically linked, but they also can stand on their own, and they're both equally important. If you can have the opportunity to say them even if they're not together. And then the Mishnah changes gears completely. And all, everyone's like, what? It seems like something's tacked on at the end. Just the way we saw at the end of chapter three, that we ended on this high note, if I'm talking about notes. And it was also about the shofar blowing and the intention of that the heart has in hearing, right? And chapter three talked about the listener and hearing the blast. And chapter four here is talking about the one who's blowing and creating the sound, right? And there at the end, we then had tacked on of chapter three, the person about the obligation of the person who was blowing. Could they fulfill it on behalf of the many? And that was about blowing. Here we have tacked on the end of the Mishnah about prayer. We go back to prayer, and this is totally out of place. It should be there in Mishnah 7 when we were talking about the prayer leader, and we have it tacked on here, but the comparison to the end of chapter 3 is also this relationship between the individual and the many, which we saw as a theme running through this entire tractate. And the end of the chapter says the following, Kishem sheshlich tzibur chayav, kach kol yachid v'yachid chayav. Right, the Tanakhama, the anonymous first voice of the rabbi says, just like the prayer leader, the shaliach, the messenger of the community, is obligated, and here we're talking about in prayer, so too is every single individual obligated in prayer. And we saw the individual's obligation mentioned in the Mishnayot earlier. If you did like this, you fulfilled your obligation. If you had this many verses, you didn't fulfill your obligation, right? And here, what's interesting is back there in Mishnah 7, we used the phrase for prayer leader, which was over lifnei hateva, the one who passes before the ark. And that showed the relationship of the person praying to the divine. And what's interesting about this other terminology that we can use of the shlich tzibor, the representative of the community, is you really see what this role of this person is. They are the go-between, they are the link between the divine and the community. They're the representative of the community that we send to stand before the divine. And so we have this chain of the divine, the shlich tzibor, and then the tzibor, and then the community of the prayer leader, and then the community. And we saw these type of links all the way through, right? We saw the moon, the divine, the Edim, then linking to the Beit Din, and we saw the Beit Din linking to the Edim, and then to the community. And here we have this same imagery of those, that partnership of three in some ways, individual, community, and the divine. We have it again in this phrase of Shlich Tzibur juxtaposed with Over Lifnei Teva. So just the rabbis think that there's an individual obligation in prayer. And it seems like it means that the individual, according to this, the individual must pray first and fulfill their individual obligation. And later on in the Tosef, there's a conversation where we see the rabbis say, the Shlich Tzibur, the prayer leader, can only fulfill it on behalf of the individual if the individual doesn't know. But if the individual knows how to daven, they have to do it themselves. Now, Rabban Gamliel has a different view. Rabbi Gamliel Omer, remember, we've seen Rabbi Gamliel throughout. Shlich tzibur motzi et harabim yedei chovatam. The prayer leader can fulfill the obligation on behalf of the many. And here we have the word rabim that we've had throughout the many chapters, and the ending is the third chapter. And it seems to be he means even if they know. Even if they know how, the shlich tzibur can fulfill it on behalf of the many. This dispute that they're having, isn't this a dispute unique to Rosh Hashanah? It's a dispute about prayer in general. This is how the Tosefta understands it and both Talmuds understand it, that it's a dispute that is about prayer in general, nothing to do with Rosh Hashanah. Is the individual required to do it if they know how? Or even if they know how, Rabbi Gamliel says, no, the prayer leader can fulfill the obligation on their behalf. But what's interesting is the conversation is presented to us in this context of Rosh Hashanah, not only in the context of Rosh Hashanah, as the pinnacle ending to Rosh Hashanah, the entire tractate. So, like, what's going on here? What's going on here at all? And it seems clear that part of it was to parallel the end of chapter 3. So at the end of chapter 3, we learned, right, we learned that the blower in some way, and we learned this also throughout our chapter here, that the blower of the shofar was like a shaliach, was a representative of the group. Even though as an individual you could hear the shofar, right, the shofar somehow connected you together, and the blower connected you to everyone who was listening. And they became the representative of the community, particularly if the community is linked to these blessings, right? That, and we said that if, how do I remind the divine by mentioning the blessings, remind the divine to remember the Jewish people, right? Is that the shofar is the one that raises up this, it's the sound of the shofar that's supposed to nudge the divine and on behalf of the entire community. So we're all listening to that sound. We're looking, our faces are looking up in the sky, like with Moshe's hands. We're all having kavanah to live, and the blower is this communal messenger to do that. What's interesting here is I learned in this chapter, and I think that possibly Rosh Hashanah is the paradigm that enables Rabbi Gamliel to have his view, because we learned in the chapter that the brachot were really the supports for the blowing, right? If I'm like, what is the point of having an extra special bracha about Kiddush Hayom, like making it so specific about the sanctity of the day, if I'm not going to blow, right? That was what Rabbi Akiva said. And so it seems to be that I've told that these two things are intrinsically linked, right? That's what I learned, that there's this song between them. And so Rabbi Gamliel says, if I know that the shofar blower can be a shliach for the tzibur and can fulfill the obligation of the community, and I know that the tefillah is really part and parcel of that same experience, there is similar experience that go hand in hand, then obviously the shlich tzibur on tefillah should be able to also fulfill the obligation of the community, because there's a parallel between them. And so he maybe learns this concept about the experience of tefillah from the shofar, which also tells us something about the experience of Rosh Hashanah. And it becomes his overall view about tefillah in general and gets put here at the end of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Okay, we've come to the end. We learned all the Mishnayot. Obviously, I want to say something about what's going on here in this chapter, and hopefully, I think the whole way through, we've been saying the themes of the chapter, the entire Masechet, but I think this will shed some light on it. I think that possibly, although we open the chapter with ideas of what our Zecha LeMikdash, or what reminds us to remember the Mikdash, the way we want the divine to be reminded to remember us, were some specific decrees that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did. I think that the continuation of the Mishnah is like that as well, right? We have Tefillah as a model. We have Hallel as a model. We have Shofar in general as a model. That is all Zecher LeMikdash. And we have the court system that is a model, etc. We focused in this chapter, as in the chapter before, on the shofar, and specifically here on the different sounds that the shofar makes and the link between the shofar and the brachot. And so what's interesting here about the different sounds that the shofar makes, it's clearly that it's the human mouth, right? It's the human mouth that makes those different sounds. I make a short sound, a long sound. I distinguish between the sounds. I blur the sounds together. And it's the human mouth that does that. And that's interesting to me, because throughout this entire tractate, there has been a focus on the human body. I don't know if I want to say the word Rosh. We saw the Rosh being something linked to the human body, but we definitely have seen an emphasis on sight, on ro'eh, right, which is mentioned at the beginning of a chapter here, right? Seeing the new moon, using our eyes, looking to the sky to see it, and that connecting us to the divine. We have seen the emphasis on hearing and using the human ear to hear, and through the hearing and what happens with our connection to our hearts, linking to the divine. And now I feel like there's a subtle link to the human mouth, and the human mouth is the one that blows, but not and creates the different sounds. But before I get to this chapter, I want to say that even throughout the whole tractate, we've seen something about the human mouth, right? It's the human beings use their mouth to testify. There was definitely an emphasis on the 18. And so human mouths, through testimony, establish fact. They create reality. They create the reality of the new moon. And then we saw the human mouth with the individual of the Rosh Beit Din, of the head of the court, and the nation as a whole. How do I sanctify it? I say, mikudash, mikudash. I use my mouth to speak the words of sanctity and create the sanctity of the new moon. So I already have a model with Kiddush HaChodesh, with sanctifying the new moon, that the human mouth creates reality by testifying and by creating a reality of holiness. And I think in this chapter, we see a similar thing of human, the human mouth and all the things the human mouth can do, right? We obviously have the rabbis all the time creating decrees with their mouths and making halachic statements with their mouths. But in this chapter, those decrees and those halachic statements were essential to creating holiness post-destruction. But we also see that the human mouth is Omer, it's Makri, it reads the verses of the Hallel, it is Mivarech, it says Brachot, right? The Levim and the Hallel, the Levim cheer, they sing with their voices. We say Hallel is another type of praise and singing. Both of those things happened in the temple, right? And we use our voices to create music like that. We are Maskir with our mouths. We remind ourselves and we remind the divine through the Zikaron to remember us with our mouth. And so this ritual that we do is so centered on creating. I want to say, I always wondered why they focused on the mess up of the Levim Shir, right? And why not the mess up of the shofar, not the mess up of the korbanot? But I think that that model of song, of human song in the Mikdash, right? We don't have the Mikdash anymore, so we can't offer korbanot, but we can offer human song. And we can offer human words and human prayer and human praise. And we can create music with our mouth, just the way the Levi'im created music in the temple. And that is another way in which we connect to the divine and that we establish holiness. And I want to say one more thing about the shofar that's so interesting to me, right? Our first information that we got about the shofar in chapter 3 is that it had to come from an animal. Right. And obviously it's an animal horn. And what's incredible about the shofar is human ingenuity. Human beings took something in nature, figured out that you could turn it into something else, and that it could create incredible song and turned it into a musical instrument. Right. If that is not another example of human beings partnering with the divine to create holiness in this world, I don't know what else is, right? We talked a lot about the partnership between human beings and the divine in creating Torah, and the partnership in the human between human beings and the divine in building this world of a working agriculture and taking nature that God has given us and turning it into food, into bread, and the power of life. But another thing that human beings do is they partner with the divine in creating song and taking natural resources and elevating them into utensils that can create holiness. And that to me is a fascinating thing about the shofar. It's just another example of this partnership that we've been seeing throughout the entire tractate, right? And we see it with the blessing of Kiddush Hayom, that human beings are the ones that create sanctity. I don't know, I'm going to throw this out there. You can write to me if you think this may be a little drushy, but if you look in the Torah in Parshat Yitro in Exodus 19:19 at the revelation on Har Sinai, the kol shofar is there, the voice of the shofar is there, and it actually sounds like it might be the divine's voice. It says the voice of the shofar becomes stronger, and Moshe speaks, and God responds b'kol, and it calls it kol shofar. And I don't know if somehow we use the shofar to talk in the divine language, to remind the divine by talking to the divine in the divine's language about the divine's relationship with us, the world, all people, and specifically the Jewish nation. But I'm not sure. Something is going on with that voice of the shofar. The last thing I wanted to say is, obviously, this has really been an introduction to the rabbinic enterprise of how they went on post-temple destruction. And the temple was a place which the Jewish people were united. We were united by the location, but we came there as individuals. We did the pilgrimage as individuals. And sometimes there were communal sacrifices offered there, but we, the individual, weren't involved. We had representatives. We had shlichim, the Kohanim were there. And when I left the temple, this is the whole question. What do we have to replace the temple? Obviously, we have court systems and we have the law. But I think that I see by the endings of these two last chapters that I am united to the rest of my community, to the Rabbim, by the ritual acts that I do and my responsibility to others, of connection to others and helping others fulfill those ritual acts. And I think we learned that mitzvah, this concept, from the Kiddush HaChodesh, from the sanctifying of the new moon, where I, as individuals, have a responsibility, all as individuals, to look to the sky, but I'm doing something on behalf of the nation, and I'm united in that ritual act. And I think the shofar does the same thing of looking to the sky. And so it's these joint ritual acts that I do, right, where I am noheg, when I have a behavior, when I am noheg to do sha, right? And if we're talking about actions, we saw really at the beginning that Rosh Hashanah is about the divine looking at our actions. And here we've had a plethora of actions of song and prayer and shofar. And it's through these joint actions that we do as individuals, but that we are linked to communities and we're linked to other individuals because they are doing the same thing on the same calendar cycle as us, on the same days, no matter where they live, Israel, or the link to the diaspora. We're all doing these same actions at the same time. It's our noheg, it's our behaviors that enable us to create kedusha, which links us both to the divine and to others around us, which is really a theme that we saw throughout. So we have done it. We have done it. We have completed the entire tractate. I hope that this has been a good experience for you in seeing that learning an entire tractate of Mishnah, that there are themes that run through it, that there's intentional language that run through it that bears out really important meta themes and ideas that were important to the Jewish people in the year 200, but are important to the Jewish people in the year in the 2000s as well. And so I say, Salik Masechet Rosh Hashanah. We have completed the tractate of Rosh Hashanah. We should come back to it. We should learn it again. And we should all have a Shana Tova, a good beginning of this year, in which we create sanctity for ourselves, for our communities, and hopefully for the nation as a whole and the world as a whole. Shana Tova.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty. And thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.